Yes, you may.
Okay, so this is page 6, and let me, I'll just run through quickly the plan of the talk. So I'll talk about the classical theory, the quantum polymer kinematics, the unitary implementation of the gauge transformations generated by the constraints, the construction of physical states by group averaging over these gauge transformations, the action of the Hamiltonian constraint, and then I'll take a brief digression to tell you about a pictorial representation of the quantum states of the theory in terms of scalar field degrees of freedom propagating on a discrete space-time. And this will help in the visualization of the ultra-locality problem and also in terms of explaining propagation. So let me now go to page 7, where I start with the classical theory. So the starting point is just the free scalar field action of a scalar field F, and I've written it down in terms of Minkowskian coordinates on a two-dimensional Minkowski space-time. So the Minkowskian coordinates are capital X, and eta is just a minus-plus diagonal, the flat metric. I can go from these capital X coordinates and just make a coordinate transformation to little x coordinates, and in doing so, I will just say that my coordinates are now parameterized in X. And when I put it back into the action, the scalar field action is now expressed in the little X. Okay, I'm getting disturbances in the middle X.
Speaker today is Madhavan, who will speak about propagation and polymer parameterized field theory.
Thanks, Jorge. So, start with page 1. That's the title of my talk, Propagation and Polymer PFT. And the talk is motivated by the issue of the non-uniqueness of the Hamiltonian constraint in loop quantum gravity. So if you turn to page 2, I'll say a little bit about this non-uniqueness. So the classical Hamiltonian constraint of GR, of course, depends on local fields such as the connection and the triad. But in LQG, we know that there is no local connection operator. There are only holonomy operators. And so I can't just take the classical expression and substitute the connection by some connection operator and get a Hamiltonian constraint operator. Instead, one has to follow a slightly indirect strategy developed by Thiemann and lots of other people. And so what one does is one first introduces a triangulation of the Cauchy slice such that in the infinite refinement of this triangulation, you get back the slice. And then one defines approximants to the local fields, which is the connection and the triad, in terms of holonomies and fluxes of small loops and surfaces associated with this triangulation. One then substitutes these approximate expressions for A and E into the Hamiltonian constraint to get an approximant Hamiltonian constraint, which in the limit of infinite refinement reproduces the continuum classical object. And finally, in the classical approximant, one replaces the holonomy and flux functions by the corresponding quantum operator and gets an approximant operator to the Hamiltonian constraint, and then one attempts to define the Hamiltonian constraint operator as a suitable continuum limit of this approximant. And remarkably, this limit operator can be defined, but the problem is that its action depends on the choice of the particular holonomy and flux approximants used to approximate the A and the E at finite triangulation. And this choice is actually infinite, and so you have an infinite non-uniqueness in the Hamiltonian constraint. So let's go to page 3. So one would like to cut down on this non-uniqueness by imposing further requirements of candidate constraint operators. So one possibility is to require that the operator have nice mathematical properties be defined on a Hilbert space, for example. Another possibility is to require that the Hamiltonian constraint operator provide a non-trivial anomaly-free representation of the constraint algebra of GR. In this talk, I will try to address yet another requirement, which is more physical, and which was articulated by Lee Smolin several years ago. So I'm going to call it Smolin's propagation requirement. And what Lee says is the following. He requires that the quantum dynamics be such that it propagates perturbations from one part of the quantum geometry to another. And this propagation is thought of as the non-perturbative seed of graviton propagation in the semi-classical or the classical limit. So this is a very reasonable requirement, and Lee argues that this requirement is unfortunately not met in LQG because the constructions of the Hamiltonian constraint all give ultra-local action. So I'll say a little bit more about this on the next slide, which is page 4. Is there a question? I can't hear.
I have a question for this slide.
Yes, please.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, just about.
Yes, I wanted to know if the three requirements which you mentioned are incompatible or whether they can be met at the same time, or do we know this?
So the requirements...
Can you repeat the question, please?
The question is, are the various requirements which one puts on the Hamiltonian constraint incompatible? And no, I don't... I mean, it's... the anomaly-free requirement is still a subject of research, and I don't think by any means that there is any incompatibility. Rather, it just hones down on your choices and makes them more and more constrained. So I think this is really one of the profitable avenues to go. There is no incompatibility.
Okay, thank you.
So let me continue with page 4 then and tell you about this ultra-locality. So the Hamiltonian constraint in all realizations we know via the Thiemann procedure acts only on vertices of a spin net. And furthermore, the action only depends on the vertex structure in an infinitesimal neighborhood of the vertex at which it is acting. The action at one vertex is completely independent of the action at some other vertex. Furthermore, repeated actions of the Hamiltonian constraint at some vertex just builds a finer and finer nest of structure localized at the vertex. So if you had vertices so intuitively far apart in the spin network, they will never talk to each other through the Hamiltonian constraint at all. And Smolin took this intuitive picture and tried to flesh it out a little bit, and he argued that it was unlikely that such a quantization could describe propagating degrees of freedom between macroscopically separated regions of the quantum geometry. Of course, his arguments were intuitive because we really don't know enough about the physical interpretation of the states, what is widely separated, indeed, what is even propagation, but the arguments, nevertheless, to me, are quite compelling. So let me go now to page 5. So what will I do in this talk? In this talk, I will examine this particular issue of ultra-locality versus propagation in the context of a certain model. And the model is called two-dimensional parameterized field theory. And I'm going to examine this issue in the context of an LQG-type polymer quantization of this model. So what is parameterized field theory? It's simply a generally covariant reformulation of free scalar field propagation on fixed flat spacetime. And I've written propagation in red to remind you that this is then a very nice model because it really, in the classical theory, all it does is describe scalar field propagation. It turns out that all steps of the LQG program, including an ambiguity-free definition of the quantum dynamics, can be completed. And this is early work with Alok Ladha. In this talk, I will show you that nevertheless, there is an ultra-locality problem. And one can clearly visualize this problem and see that repeated action of the Hamiltonian constraint cannot give us long-range propagation. On the other hand, I will also tell you in this talk that physical states of the theory in this quantization actually describe scalar field propagation. So how can this be? And the idea is to tease this tension between these two statements, and maybe we learn something about appropriate choices in LQG, which may be able to also give propagation simultaneously with ultra-local action. Let me now come to page 5, and where I just list out the plan of the talk. And unfortunately, because parameterized field theory is probably not familiar to most of you, most of the talk will be a review of the classical and quantum theory. And it's only the last two points where I will come to the new results. So I'll start with the classical theory. Move on to the point. Can you imagine it? It's on the server. Hello? Can you hear me?
Yeah, there is a lot of noise. Does everyone have their phone muted?
Yes, it was. Now it's again.
Should I just continue?
No, I don't think people can understand you, so I'll again stop the call and start it again.
Before you continue, I have a question here. So the new coordinates, the little t and little x's, are they also Cartesian coordinates? Because you still use...
They are just arbitrary coordinates, and all I have done is express the same action in different formats. I think I'm getting new at this point. Oh, man, not only of the scalar field, but not only of the scalar matter field, but also of two new scalar fields. Capital X is can you hear me now? The disturbance seems to have gone. Okay.
Yeah.
So now what I'm doing is I'm taking these Minkowskian coordinates, which are now functions of the little x, and I'm just adjoining them as variables to be varied in the action. That's all I'm doing. So the parameterized field theory action now is to be taken to be a functional of little f and capital X, and all over the place where you have the little alpha beta, where you have eta alpha beta, it's going to depend on this field capital X. So when I vary with respect to the scalar field, then of course all I'm doing is I'm getting equations, free scalar field equation written in terms of these arbitrary little x coordinates. The content is exactly the same as just free scalar field on Minkowski spacetime. If I vary the capital X's, it turns out that I don't get any new equations. Therefore, the X's, the capital X's, are just undetermined functions of the little x and little t, and therefore there are these two functions now worth of gauge. Indeed, since little x and t are arbitrary, there is a general covariance in the system, and this all I've done is I've written free scalar field theory in some fake generally covariant disguise. So now I can go to the Hamiltonian theory, and corresponding to the two-dimensional general covariance, the Hamiltonian theory has two constraints. And before I come to the Hamiltonian theory in more detail, I just want to remark that the free scalar field solutions, of course, in two dimensions, can be written in terms of right movers and left movers, which only have dependence on one set of the null coordinates each. And this split into left and right movers is really behind the explicit solvability, even in the quantum theory, in the polymer representation of this particular model. So let's now go to the next page, 8. So in the Hamiltonian description, now capital T and capital X are canonical variables, and I can use light cone combinations of them, T plus minus capital X, because as we'll see, the theory simplifies in terms of these variables. And then the phase space consists of the matter field and its conjugate momentum, and the X plus and the X minus and their conjugate momentum. You have two constraints corresponding to the two-dimensional general covariance, and it's not really necessary to see the exact form of these constraints. It turns out, as you may expect, that if I gauge fix by choosing the capital X coordinates to agree with the little x ones, that is, if I deparametrize the theory, I get back the standard flat spacetime free scalar field action. So really the dynamical content is really nothing but that of a free scalar field on flat spacetime. It becomes convenient to define a canonical transformation on the matter variables to some new variables, y plus and minus. Again, the exact form is not important. All that is important is that the plus and the minus variables Poisson commute, and the plus with plus and the minus with minus give you some non-trivial derivative of delta functions. Similarly, the H plus and the H minus constraints commute, and the Poisson bracket algebra between the H pluses is isomorphic to the Lie algebra of vector fields on the Cauchy slice, and this is also true for the Poisson bracket algebra between the H minuses. Indeed, it turns out that the H plus and the H minus generate spatial diffeomorphisms of the plus and minus fields. So the H plus constraint generates diffeomorphisms, say phi plus, of all the plus variables and leaves the minus variables untouched. And the H minus generates diffeomorphism phi minus of the minus fields and leaves the plus fields untouched. And so evolution is just equivalent to two independent diffeomorphisms. And that's why we can solve this model, because we know in LQG very well how to deal with spatial diffeomorphisms. Let me now go to page 9. Because the model is very simple, one has a ready space-time interpretation of the canonical data, and I would like to devote a little bit of time to this. So consider the canonical variables capital X and T, or the light cone combinations capital X plus and capital X minus. Now these variables are called embedding variables for a particular reason. So let us take a point little x on the slice sigma and evaluate capital X and capital T, the data at that point. This picks out a coordinate point in the flat spacetime, because now I've given you the values of the two inertial coordinates, x and t, and I can plot that point in flat spacetime. And as I vary x over the Cauchy slice, this point moves in spacetime and gives me an embedding of this Cauchy slice in the flat spacetime. So that's why these canonical variables are called embedding variables. Let us now go to page 10. And here I pictorially just show the action of the constraints. So we start off with data on the Cauchy slice on the left. I have X plus minus and some matter data, Y plus minus. And after you add finite transformations by the constraints, you get some new data. I can take the old data, and it corresponds to an embedded slice in the spacetime with some matter data on it, which I call y plus minus. I can take this initial data for the matter, and I can evolve it through the free scalar field equation in spacetime, and I can look at what the data is induced on the new slice given by the new canonical data, x plus minus nu. And of course, what I will find is that the matter data is exactly y plus minus nu. So one can easily go back and forth between the Hamiltonian theory and the covariant equations. I wanted to stress again that y plus and x plus nu are obtained by the action of a diffeomorphism on the plus variables, and similarly, the new minus variables are obtained by the action of an independent diffeomorphism on the old minus variables. And by choosing these diffeomorphisms, one can vary where the final slice is in the spacetime. The other figure below, I think we can ignore for the time being because there is really not enough time. Let's go to page 11. So now, before I start on the polymer quantization, I just want to note that not much is known regarding the polymer representation on non-compact spaces. And so what I'm going to do is set the Cauchy slice to have circular topology so that the space-time is a cylinder. And it turns out that there are some complications coming from the use of angular charts, both on the Cauchy slice as well as in the flat spacetime, and these complications can be taken care of satisfactorily both in classical and quantum theory, and they will really not impinge much on the considerations of this talk, so we can really skip them. So let me now go to the next page, 12, where I start talking about the quantum kinematics, and let me focus on the embedding sector, and that too on the plus sector. So we have the canonical coordinates pi plus and x plus. And pi plus is like the connection of LQG. X plus is like the triad variable. So one has holonomies of pi plus as the basic functions. The holonomies are defined by graphs. So what is a graph? A graph is just a set of edges which covers the circular Cauchy slice. The analog of the SU2 spins of LQG are just integer-valued labels, which I will call charges, and there is one integer-valued label for each edge of the graph. And I can then define the holonomy by integrating over the momentum along the edge, multiplying it by the charge, summing over all the edges, and exponentiating the result. So that is the holonomy. The electric field is just capital X, and the Poisson brackets close. And basically, you get a factor of a charge whenever the argument of capital X plus sits inside one of the edges of the graph. So let me now go to the quantum theory representation of these Poisson brackets on page 13. So the states are basically what I would call charge network states. And charge network states are labeled by a graph, and the edges of this graph are labeled by these charges, k plus E1, k plus E2, etc. The main thing I want you to take away from this slide is that the embedding coordinate operator acts diagonally on these charge network states, and whenever the argument little x is inside some edge E, it gives an eigenvalue h bar k plus E. The holonomies act in a certain way, which we won't worry about, and the inner product is the usual Kronecker delta inner product. As I said, the range of these charges is integer valued, and however, because of the dimensions of the various fields, it turns out that h bar k has dimensions of length, and it is this h bar k which takes values as integer-valued multiples of some dimensionful parameter, little a, and this little a is like the Barbero-Imerizzi parameter, except that it has dimensions of length, and if we choose different values of a, you can see that the spectrum of the embedding coordinate operator differs, and so these values of A label inequivalent representations, and we'll just fix little a once and for all and continue. So the same structure is there also for the minus vector. So let me now go to page 14. It turns out that one can also define holonomies and their representation on the matter sector, and you have matter charge networks, which are again labeled by graphs with integer valued matter charges on them. You have a plus matter sector and a minus matter sector. And then the kinematic Hilbert space is obtained as the product of all these four things, the plus and the minus embedding and the matter charge networks. So let me then, if there are any questions, I can take them now. Okay, so let me continue then to page 15. Yes?
Yeah, I have a question. So at some point when you see that this is, had you done the gauge fixing at the very beginning or the deparametrization, that it would just see the free boson conformal field theory?
Yes.
So is there any way to see that the quantization of it should have something to do with the C equals 1 conformal field theory?
Well, it turns out you cannot recover all the symmetries of you know, the classical theory in this quantization. So it's certainly not, I'm not promoting it as a physical quantization for scalar field theory. In particular, you even break Lorentz invariance, let alone conformal invariance. But what this model is good for is really for testing structural issues in LQG, and that is what I'm concentrating on in this talk.
Thank you.
Okay, so on page 15, we have, I've written the kinematic Hilbert space, which is a product of the plus and minus sectors. And for example, if I look at a charge network in the plus sector, it's labeled by a graph, and then each edge of the graph now is labeled not only by an embedding charge, but also a matter charge. What about gauge transformations? I told you these gauge transformations act only as diffeomorphisms, so we know very well how they act. They just take these colored graphs and they move them around the circle. It turns out that the matter charges really just move along with this diffeomorphism. The embedding charges actually get augmented by certain factors of 2 pi. That has to do with the circular topology, but it's not something which we need to worry about in this talk. So as far as the picture goes, you can just visualize this to be some diffeomorphism which is moving these charge network states around, one for the plus and one for the minus. Let me now go to page 16. Since everything is just spatial diffeomorphism, we know how to construct physical states by group averaging, just as we do for spatial diffeos in LQG. And the group average of a tensor product charge net is just a distribution, which is a sum over all gauge-related images of the particular state being group averaged over. And these images are just, you take the plus bra and you move it by plus diffeomorphism, and the minus one by minus diffeomorphism, and you take all inequivalent gauge-related bras and you sum them up, and that gives you a well-defined distribution. Now it turns out that there is a very nice geometrical interpretation both for a kinematic charge net as well as for the physical state obtained by its group average. And I'd like to spend now a little bit of time describing this picture because it's very useful for what I want to say later. So let me then go to page 17. So what is this geometrical picture? So first, of course, we have a tensor product state between a plus and a minus state. And I can, of course, go to a fine enough graph underlying both the plus charge net and the minus charge net. And on this fine enough graph, each edge of the graph will now be labeled by four charges, namely two embedding charges, a plus and a minus, and two matter charges, a plus and a minus. So just to say that again, I started out with a plus cross minus state, and the plus state, its edges were labeled by two charges, a plus embedding charge and a plus matter charge, and similarly for the minus. And now by going to a fine enough graph, each edge of this graph is labeled by a K plus K minus pair and an L plus L minus pair, which is the matter. Okay. Now, the K plus minus, recall, these are eigenvalues of the embedding coordinate operator X hat plus minus. So therefore, I can simply take the numerical value K plus and K minus, which comes from a particular edge of the charge net, and that defines for me a point in flat space-time, because it just gives me the coordinates X plus and X minus of that point. So I can plot that point in flat space-time. Further, that same edge also has the matter labels, L plus and L minus. So on that point, I can associate the matter label pair, L plus and L minus. Now I can do this for all the edges of the given charge net, and it turns out that I get a discrete Cauchy slice with quantum matter charges on each point of this slice. And it's discrete because, of course, the K plus and the K minus are integer-valued multiples of this spacing A. What about the action of gauge transformations? Well, the gauge transformations phi plus and phi minus move the plus and minus edges independently. So, if you take a particular charge network and move its plus edges in one way and the minus edges in another way, the new charge network will have different pairs of embedding charge values and matter charge values. And these different pairs will then define different points in space-time and a different Cauchy, discrete Cauchy slice with matter excitations thereon. And in this way, the initial discrete Cauchy slice with data has now propagated to the final Cauchy slice with data. It then turns out that if one looks at the whole group averaged physical state, one can associate with it the entire discrete space-time with matter propagating on it. And in this sense, the quantization really visually encodes propagation effects. So I'll just come to drawing it in pictures on the next slide, page 18. So I have the kinematic state, which is a product of the plus and minus states, and then the eigenvalues of the X plus and X minus operators are just K plus and K minus, and I can plot them as points, which I then form the slice sigma, and I can color these points by the matter charges L plus and L minus. And then if I take a gauge transformation, I get a new charge net, which represents an evolved Cauchy slice with evolved data. What about the group average? Well, in the group average, I have a sum over many, many charge nets. So I can look at a particular summand and associate with that summand a particular discrete Cauchy slice with matter data on it, and I can plot it in the space-time. I can look at any other summand and also plot that in the same space-time. It turns out, because the group averaging has been done while respecting the constraint algebra of the theory, that all these different slices stack up consistently to a single discrete space-time with quantum matter on it. In other words, if I have two summons which have edges which have the same embedding charge labels, it turns out that they will also have exactly the same matter charge labels, so you have a complete consistent discrete space-time with matter propagating on it.
Okay.
Yes.
So in the first, the top figure, what is it
yes.
on K and on K plus and K minus? Should they not satisfy some constraints to ensure that the embedding is a space-like slice?
Yes.
Can you repeat the question, please?
Yes. So Abhay wants to know, how come if I plot these values of K plus and K minus, I actually get something which looks like a discrete version of a Cauchy slice? And for example, why don't these points just lie along, some t equal to constant, an x equal to constant line or something? And I omitted, of course, the fine print. And the fine print is that there is a super selection sector. In this super selection sector, the values of the charges on adjacent edges have to satisfy certain inequalities, and it is because of the satisfaction of these inequalities that what you get are really discrete versions of Cauchy slices and not something else. Does that answer the question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so let me now go to the next page, number 19. Now, up to now, I was only looking at the plus and minus constraints and telling you how the quantum theory was set up. But in LQG, we have the classical diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraints and their quantization. So let me look at PFT again, not in terms of the plus and minus constraints, but in terms of the diffeomorphism and the Hamiltonian constraints. I've just written out for completeness the H plus and H minus expressions. They are not that important. But it turns out that if you simply take linear combination H plus plus H minus, then what you get is the diffeomorphism constraint. And I've written it out in full glory because it immediately tells you that it generates spatial diffeomorphisms. So this is a constraint combination which generates evolution along the Cauchy slice, and in terms of the gauge transformations phi plus and phi minus, a spatial diffeomorphism because of the plus sign between the H plus and H minus, a spatial diffeomorphism corresponds to transformation in which the phi plus diffeomorphism is the same as the phi minus diffeomorphism. So that everything, the plus and the minus fields, all move together, and really that is what you expect a spatial diffeomorphism to do. And that is shown in the left figure. I have data x plus minus and y plus minus. I make a diffeomorphism, so I have new data, which are just dragged along by the orbits of this diffeomorphism. The plus and minus fields are dragged along by the same diffeomorphism. And really, when one plots the sets of these data in space-time, as embedded slices with matter data, the point is that what the space-time picture gives you is the relation between the matter data and the embedding data. And this relation is spatial diffeomorphism invariant, and so it plots to the same slice in the flat space-time. So let me now go to the Hamiltonian constraint. The Hamiltonian constraint, it turns out, is just the other combination. It's H plus minus H minus. And this is the combination which classically generates motion along the unit time-like normal to the Cauchy slice, where the normal is defined with respect to the background flat space-time metric. In this case, because of the minus sign, the finite transformation generated by the Hamiltonian constraint corresponds to the choice phi plus equal to phi minus inverse. So again, I have data x plus x minus, y minus, etc. I move this data, but now I move the plus fields in a certain way by phi star, and I move the minus fields by the inverse diffeomorphism. And so what happens is that you don't no longer get the same embedded slice, you get a different embedded slice with different matter data on it. And that is really how evolution proceeds normal to the slice. So much for the classical diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraints. Let us now come to their quantum versions in the already specified quantum theory, which I've discussed. So let me now go to page 20. I've already said for the diffeomorphisms that 5 plus and 5 minus are identical, so they're just the spatial diffeomorphism phi. And what the corresponding unitary operator does is it moves both the plus and the minus charge networks together. And of course, one can solve the diffeomorphism constraint simply by group averaging over these spatial diffeomorphisms. So more explicitly, I've just shown you the action of this diffeomorphism. So let me consider a part of a charge network which has a black edge and a red edge that embeds to a certain discrete slice with some data in the space-time. Now let me act upon it by a finite diffeomorphism. So for example, this diffeomorphism could squeeze the black edge a little bit and extend the red edge a bit, but what it cannot do is really alter the actual values of the charges. And so if I look at what slice the diffeomorphic charge network maps onto, it's exactly the same slice. And here I have not shown you the matter data, but the matter data just goes along for the ride. And so you have exactly the same quantum matter data on the same discrete slice corresponding to two diffeomorphically related charge networks. And here I just wanted to write down at the bottom that really these charge network states are products of plus and minus. Let me now come to the Hamiltonian constraint and slowly start talking about ultralocality and so on. So let me now go to page 21. And what we will do, what actually Alok and I already did, was we could construct a Thiemann type of quantization. I mean, we could construct the Hamiltonian constraint through a Thiemann procedure. So what one gets is a finite triangulation Hamiltonian constraint, and then one has to take its continuum limit. It turns out that at finite triangulation, the constraint, the various choices which go into the construction of the finite triangulation constraint can be made in such a way that this finite triangulation constraint acts as an infinitesimal version of what you would like the Hamiltonian constraint to do. Let me say that again. We know, I've just discussed, that the Hamiltonian constraint in the classical theory generates transformations which correspond to the combination phi plus equal to phi minus inverse. It turns out that one can take the Hamiltonian constraint expression, one can choose approximate appropriate holonomy approximants, etc., and come up with a construction of the Hamiltonian constraint at finite triangulation such that what it does on charge networks is a kind of infinitesimal version of this phi plus equal to phi minus inverse. So let me say that in a little bit more detail now. And in order to say that, consider a diffeomorphism, which I call phi delta V. This is a diffeomorphism which is only non-trivial in the neighborhood of some point V and which pulls this point V to the right by a coordinate amount delta. In terms of this diffeomorphism, the action of the Hamiltonian constraint at finite triangulation is as follows. So C hat delta Hamiltonian, that is the finite triangulation Hamiltonian constraint, it pulls the two plus edges which intersect at V towards the right as phi delta V. And it pulls at the same time the two minus edges which intersect at V to the left by the inverse, phi inverse delta V. And that is really how the phi plus equal to phi minus inverse creeping in to the action of the Hamiltonian constraint. More in detail, if I have a charge network state psi, it turns out that the Hamiltonian constraint at finite triangulation, just as in LQG, acts only at vertices. At each vertex V, you have a factor of the lattice evaluated at the vertex. You have an operator in red, and that operator in red is exactly the operator which pulls the plus vertex to the right and the minus vertex to the left. And then you have a minus 1 divided by delta. So the object in red I'm going to call U hat Hamiltonian delta V, and this is the object which moves the plus edges to the right and the minus edges to the left. Now it turns out that one could equally well have made other choices for various holonomy approximants, etc., such that the final operator one obtained was such that it pulled the plus charges not to the right, but to the left. And it pulled the minus vertex structure not to the left, but to the right. In other words, one could equally well have constructed a Hamiltonian constraint at finite triangulation in which the U-hat Hamiltonian delta V is replaced by its kinematic adjoint. And I will show you towards the end of the talk that in order to regain propagation, it is very important to impose both this initial constraint and its kinematic adjoint as constraints in the quantum theory. And just as a small remark, remember that we are really interested in the action of these operators for sufficiently small delta, because finally we are interested in the continuum limit, which is delta going to zero. And it turns out that for sufficiently small delta, in practical terms, what it means is that if you go to small enough delta and you decrease delta further, the action gives you a charge network whose diffeomorphism class does not change as you go on decreasing delta. So let me now go to page 21, where I actually show you in diagram as to how the Hamiltonian constraint acts, and also how the ultra-locality and the lack of propagation come about. So again, here I'm not going to show the matter charges, because the matter charges just come along for the ride along with the embedding charges. And they will just clutter up this already cluttered slide. So let me now consider part of a charge network. I've shown you a vertex between the black and the red edges, and I have U Hamiltonian phi delta. I've omitted the little V label because it's apparent from the context that it's acting on this particular vertex. So what does this operator do? It takes the minus charges and pulls them left. And it should actually be a phi delta inverse. I'm sorry, I made a little bit of a mistake while drawing this slide. Instead of the phi delta, it should be phi delta inverse, which pulls the minus charges to the left. And so you can see that the red minus edge has been stretched towards the left. What about the plus edge? Well, the plus edge is pulled by phi delta to the right. And so the black edge has now been extended a little bit at the cost of the red edge. So if I look at the original charge network with these two edges, with K1 plus K1 minus and K2 plus K2 minus, I get the action of the Hamiltonian constraint, or the action of this U hat Ham delta, and it gives me a charge network with three edges. The outer edges have exactly the same charge labels as before, but now you also have this inner edge because you have pulled these two charges in opposite directions. Supposing I plotted the original charge net, and supposing the K1 plus K1 minus and the K2 plus K2 minus were two space-like related points, then if I go to the deformed one, you can see that the middle edge has the same K1 plus as the left edge and the same K2 minus as the right edge, and so it is null related to these two space-like related points. Okay, now let us see what happens when we repeat the action of the Hamiltonian constraint, or of repeat the action of this U hat Hamiltonian. So I take the charge network with these three edges. And now you can choose whichever vertex you want to act upon. Let us choose the left one. I'm going to pull the K1, the K2 minus charge to the left at the left vertex, and I'm going to put the K1 plus charge to the right. And you can see, if you think about it, that the net effect is only to increase the size of the K1 plus K2 minus edge and shrink the K1 plus K1 minus edge a little bit. But the actual sequence of charges has not changed. And so if I plot it in the discrete space-time, I get exactly the same set of 3 points. So repeated actions, you can check whether I do it with U Hamiltonian on one vertex or the other, whether I do it with U Hamiltonian adjoint on one vertex or the other. Repeated actions simply cannot get you beyond this configuration which I have drawn. And therefore, really, there is no propagation. So let me summarize that on the next slide. And I'm sorry, please ignore the text and only look at the diagrams, because the text is not written very well. So what I've shown in the left diagram is the pictorial representation of a charge network. So there is some matter on a discrete slice. Now I act on this charge network by either U Hamiltonian of phi delta or U adjoint Hamiltonian of phi delta. And what happens is that this discrete slice is deformed one lattice spacing to the past, or if I acted first by the U adjoint, one lattice spacing to the future, but nothing beyond that. Thus, the discrete evolution just gets stuck to one lattice translation and nothing more. And this is really a visual representation of the fact that repeated actions of the Hamiltonian constraint cannot give you long-range propagation. Now, the way I have set this up and shown it, perhaps it has slightly obscured the fact that the reason this happens is really due to the ultra-locality of the Hamiltonian constraint action. And let me therefore focus a little bit on this and try to convince you that the reason we don't get this propagation is really the reason which Lee had propounded, namely that we have an ultra-local action. So let me now go to the next page, 24. Now, what is the real characteristic of this ultra-local action? It's the fact that I have a small parameter delta, and I only move the vicinity of some vertex structure by an infinitesimally small amount delta. In order to see the contrast with what can actually be achieved by finite gauge transformations, let me first discuss the action of finite gauge transformations. And it will be apparent that finite gauge transformations can do something crucial which the ultra-local action of this small delta deformation can never achieve for you. So let me now look at a charge network state. And for simplicity, let me look only at a phi minus gauge transformation. So I'm not going to do anything to the plus charges. And of course, if I look at an appropriate phi minus gauge transformation, I can drag all the minus charges as much as I want to the left and all along. And it turns out that this is really something which cannot be done with the U Hamiltonian delta operator. So let me go slowly, step by step. Let me consider the charge network with three edges and let their embedding charges be such, for example, that they have points which are space-like related to each other. In the second charge network, what I've done is I've pulled the K2 minus charge a little bit to the left. So it goes and slides a little bit onto the K1 plus edge. It displaces the K1 minus edge a little bit onto the K3 plus edge. And therefore, I have the original edges, which are already given by the black lattice points, But I have the two new purple points, which are the K3 plus K1 minus edge and the K1 plus K2 minus edge. And I've plotted them as well. And here we have gone one lattice spacing to the past. Let me push a little bit more to the left. And now what I'm doing is I'm pushing the K2 minus so that it completely displaces the K1 minus out of the K1 plus edge. So the K1 minus now to the K3 plus edge. And you have the K3 plus edge. As a result, if I look at the lattice diagram, I no longer have the K1 plus K1 minus point. I'm again getting disturbance. Can you hear me? Maybe you can hear. Should I continue? Okay, it seems to have been. Can I? I'm still getting a lot of.
I guess we'll have to set the call again. Hold on. Continue.
Okay, so let's get back to page 24. And I'm looking at the third figure, the third charge network, the curved arrow which goes down. And here, what I was saying was that I pushed the K2 minus so that it completely occupies the K1 plus edge. And therefore, there is now a missing point. There is no K1 plus K1 minus. And finally, I can go further left, and I can push the K2 minus all the way so that it enters into the K3 plus edge. And the combination K3 plus K2 minus gives me the red lattice point, which is two time steps to the past. And that is how I get past the barrier of one step to two steps. And in order to get past that barrier, it is absolutely crucial that the K1 plus K1 minus point has disappeared. And it is this disappearance which is simply not possible by the ultra-local action of the Hamiltonian constraint. And let me say why that is so. So let me now go to page 25. What the Hamiltonian constraint action does is that it takes some vertex structure and it just modifies it a very small neighborhood of the vertex. So if I have some original edge labels, it may introduce new edge labels, but it can never eliminate old edge labels at all because it can't do anything very violent. Simply because it's an ultra-local action and its action is confined to the very small vicinity of a particular vertex. So there is absolutely no way any of the original edge label combinations can be caused to disappear. And this is really, it turns out, the crucial reason as to why this ultra-local action can never get you long-range propagation. So to summarize, Lee is absolutely correct. The Hamiltonian constraint has an ultra-local action, and repeated action of the Hamiltonian constraint does not result in long-range propagation exactly for the reasons anticipated by Lee. So let me now then advocate a slightly different perspective on what propagation is. Clearly, propagation is not achieved by repeated actions of the Hamiltonian constraint, but maybe that's the wrong place to look for propagation. So let us go now to page 26. So rather than asking if repeated actions of the constraint give propagation, we should really be asking if the joint kernel of the diffeomorphism constraint and the Hamiltonian constraint encodes propagation. What do I mean by this? Well, let me consider an element of this joint kernel. And let me call it psi. Then psi, of course, has to be diffeomorphism invariant. And so it's already going to be a sum over all diff-related images of a particular charge net. And then it also has to satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint. Therefore, in general, I would expect psi to be some distributional sum over charge net bra states. And I will say that psi describes propagation if the following statement holds. Supposing, as a summand in this sum which represents psi, we have a particular bra, and that bra pictorially represents a discrete Cauchy slice with some matter data. Then I will say that psi encodes propagation if it necessarily has a bra corresponding to any finite evolution of this discrete slice and matter data. Okay, so that is what I will call as propagation. That is how I recognize that an element of the kernel actually describes or encodes propagation effects. I would like you to skip the third point because it just gets a little confusing and there's really no necessity of saying it over here. So let's go straight to the fourth point on page 26. It turns out that in order to show that the elements of the joint kernel of the diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraints describe propagation of the sort which I've just defined, we have to show the following statement. And if we show this following statement, then it turns out that a lot of other algebraic manipulation leads to the fact that you can show finite propagation. So what is this particular statement I need to show? It's as follows. What I need to show is that if you have a state psi, which is killed by the diffeomorphism Hamiltonian constraints, and supposing in that state psi, as a summand, I have a bra, which has, for example, the k1 plus k1 minus edge of the previous slide. So let me go back to page 25. On page 25, supposing we have the state in the kernel of the constraints, and supposing it has, as a summand, a charge net with the sequence of charges on the left, that it has a charge net with a k1 plus k1 minus edge. Then, what I really need to show, the key point is that I need to show that this element psi also has as a summand the charge net with the sequence on the right side. Okay, that is the charge net without the k1 plus k1 minus edge. And that is what I'm going to devote the remainder of 5 or 10 minutes of the talk to. So I'm going to show that, of course, while ultralocal action of Hamiltonian constraint cannot get you from the left charge net to the right charge net on page 25, nevertheless, if I look at a logically distinct question, namely at the joint kernel of the Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraints, then if I take a particular state in this kernel, which has as a summand the charge net on the left, then it definitely will have as a summand the charge net on the right. So that is what I'm going to show now. So let us then go past page 26 to page 27. And before I prove what I'm going to, before I start the proof, I just want to use some convenient language. And I'm going to say that a charge net C is in psi. I'm going to use this to mean that the bra C is actually a summand in the sum representing the distribution psi. So I'm just going to, for short, use the language C's in psi. Okay, now let us consider psi, which is annihilated by the diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraints. Then it follows that a charge net C is in psi if and only if the following holds. Firstly, all spatial diffeomorphic images of C are in psi. This, of course, has to be the case because psi is a solution of the diffeomorphism constraint. But more non-trivially, supposing we have C which is in psi, then it turns out that the action U Hamiltonian delta on C for all sufficiently small delta, all these charge nets for sufficiently small delta also have to be in psi. Why is that? Well, if you look at the line in brackets, I've written down the Hamiltonian constraint. It's U minus 1. So if psi has C in it, I'm going to get a non-trivial contribution from the minus 1. And that contribution better be cancelled by some contribution which goes and hits the U Hamiltonian delta times C. And therefore, one concludes that U Hamiltonian delta times C better be also in psi and vice versa. Similarly, the same statement is true for the adjoint. U adjoint Hamiltonian delta C also has to be in psi for sufficiently small delta because I am imposing not only the constraint, but also its kinematic adjoint as a constraint in the quantum theory. So to summarize what my argument is going to be on the next page, I'm simply going to show that I have a sequence of charge nets starting from the left charge net on page 25, which had the K1 plus K1 minus edge, and it will go to the right charge net, which does not have that edge, and all the intermediate charge nets are going to be related by the action either of U hat Hamiltonian delta or U adjoint Hamiltonian delta. And therefore, all of them will be in psi. So let me do that. This is the last slide before the conclusion. And let me go slowly. So I'm starting with the charge net with those three edges. On page 28, I'm starting with the charge net. It has the 3, the 1, and the 2 charges. And on the 1-2 vertex, I'm going to act with U Hamiltonian of delta. So it is going to take the minus charge and pull it one way to the left. The K2 minus charge is pulled to the left. The K1 plus charge is pulled to the right. One has a new edge, which is K1 plus K2 minus. On this charge net, I'm going to now act on the 3-1 vertex, and as a result, I get the third charge net, which has got the sequence K3 plus K3 minus, K3 plus K1 minus. That is the new edge, because what I've done is I've pulled K1 minus to the left and K3 plus to the right, so I have this new edge. Then I have, of course, K1 plus K1 minus, K1 plus K2 minus, and K2 plus K2 minus. Okay, and now this is really the key point of the whole exercise. Let me look on the right-hand side at the desired charge net. That desired charge net, I've written down the sequence K3 plus K3 minus, K3 plus K1 minus, K1 plus K2 minus, and K2 plus K2 minus, and it does not have any K1 plus K1 minus edge. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to act on this charge net by U adjoint Hamiltonian delta at the vertex which I've indicated by the red arrow. So what this is going to do is it's going to pull the K1 plus charge to the left and the K1 minus charge to the right. And therefore, it is going to generate for me an edge precisely with K1 plus K1 minus. And that is exactly diffeomorphic to the last charge network, which is linked to it by this purple arrow. Okay? So all these four charge nets have to be in psi. If the first charge net is in psi, then the charge net without the K1 plus K1 minus H is also in psi. And clearly, I cannot get the initial and the final charge nets from each other just by the action of U Hamiltonian delta or U adjoint Hamiltonian delta. It's far more subtle, and the entire procedure is laid out over here and has to do with the detailed structure of the Hamiltonian constraint and what sort of states are in its kernel. So let me now conclude on page 29. So what I've shown you is that ultra-locality of the action of the Hamiltonian constraint does not preclude propagation. So rather than see propagation in terms of the action of repeated action of the Hamiltonian constraint, we should see propagation as a pattern written on the entire set of kinematic bras which comprise a given physical state. If I look at propagation in this way, then the propagation is a result of the particular U adjoint minus 1 structure of the finite triangulation Hamiltonian constraint. And also very crucial is the fact that I have to impose the kinematic adjoint of this constraint also as a constraint in the quantum theory. So both of these have to be imposed. Now it turns out that this is a general structural lesson. One should seek perhaps this sort of a structure in whatever Hamiltonian constraint for LQG one is building, and one should thereby try to find a physically correct Hamiltonian constraint which also allows for propagation. And I do not have time to say this. These are just very preliminary results, but there are interesting results for this abelian so-called U1 cube model, where one sees a possibility that these general structural lessons could be somehow imported and one could get some sort of propagation. So I'm just leaving you with a very qualitative picture on the last slide, which is page 30. I do not say that this is how things will happen, but it opens up a window as to how one might look for propagation effects. So I've just drawn some spin network state with vertices A and B. And propagation means that there is some exchange of information between the vertex A and the vertex B, so that what you end up with just at the same horizontal line is some new vertex structure, A prime and B prime, which is a result of A sending some information to B. How could this be possible? Well, supposing I act with a kind of Hamiltonian constraint on the vertex A, and I deform it with these little red web over here, and I get some new vertex structure with this extra structure here, I can now act by spatial diffeomorphism, which essentially drags this structure and brings it to the vicinity of B. And then one can hope that acting on the A prime B prime desired charge net by some adjoint Hamiltonian constraint actually gives you exactly the A prime B structure. And one may be able to then conclude that if the AB structure is there, then so is the A prime B prime. And I think that at least in the abelian model, maybe one can try to work towards this and hopefully then see whether one can make progress in LQG. So that ends my talk. Thanks a lot for listening to it throughout all these interruptions. Thank you.
Questions?
Hamiltonian, repeated action of the Hamiltonian, all that is what one would do
if in fact it was a true Hamiltonian, which was generating that atom. And therefore, I always tell that the non-trivial question is really solving the Hamiltonian constraint, and whether it is ultra-local or not. And then the question is there some sense in which there is propagation and dynamics that can be read off in the space of solutions to all the constraints? And this is a viewpoint that you have also said just now, as far as I could understand it.
Yes.
So now, the key question is the last question, namely that what do we mean that if the resulting solution, we should be able to see the propagation? Now, I would like to make kind of two ways of thinking about it. First, I would like, the second is what you are proposing. The first that I would like to take is just the way that people like Jurek and Christina and others were proposing in full loop quantum gravity. They were looking at loop quantum gravity with a scalar field. Now, heuristically, I can think of this scalar field as an embedding variable, in the sense that generating equal value, phi equal to constant, gives me a particular slice space time in any given solution. There's a precise sense in which this is true. It spells out what is the class of space times and solutions we're looking at. So in that case, the Hamiltonian constraint for them was just, on the geometrical side, there's a Riemann constraint. And then on the matter side, it was basically I h bar d by d phi, where phi is a scalar field, is operating with psi, is equal to, on the right-hand side, some constraints, square roots and such things. But on the right-hand side, it was all kind of really ultra-local construction. And it seems to me that in this case, one would be able to see propagation as you go from one phi, one internal time variable scalar field, to another phi, internal time variable scalar field, and one could draw space-time diagrams that are very similar to what you are writing down, namely that the embedding variable is in phi. So my first question to you is that, is this not a realization of this kind of idea that you are saying? Because the solution of the Hamiltonian constraint there really has information about what, I mean, it is, if you like, it is obtained by group averaging of the Hamiltonian constraint, and therefore it has information about what the wave function does for all possible phi, in other words, all possible embedding.
Right. So, so I'll tell you what my own kind of attitude is. I think that's a fine path to pursue. But my problems always are that whenever one tries to define these operators, there are lots and lots of choices which go into their definition. And of course, when one uses a scalar field as a clock, etc., then there is this extra structure which kind of, no matter what choice one really looks in detail for the Hamiltonian constraint side of the operator, for a very generic reason, as you pointed out, you do expect to get some sort of evolution. So that is really to do with the sort of classical structure of the constraint and the ability to choose some variable as a clock. And I don't have anything against it, except that what I am interested in currently over here is to really cut down on the amount of choice in the very definition of the operator. And I find that this way of looking at it gives you yet another requirement by which you could try and home in on the right Hamiltonian constraint action. Peripherally, there is another point I'd also like to make, and which I think we all know this, but I think each time it's probably good to emphasize this.
We start off with the classical theory with smooth fields, etc. And when we come to the polymer quantization, we are ending up in a very kind of a discrete quantum geometry excitations. Now, if I look at, for example, even in the parameterized field theory case, if I looked at the classical Hamiltonian constraint and I looked at its vector field, I could actually take this vector field and I could integrate it out and I could get no problem with evolution. Right? So classically, it's like taking repeated actions of the Hamiltonian constraint through Poisson brackets and building up some notion of evolution, even though it's a constraint, actually in terms of embeddings moving up and the scalar field evolving, you can actually integrate things out. This does not happen with the ultra-local action over here, precisely because of these discrete structures which come in. And so no matter how many times you hit with the Hamiltonian constraint, you really never end up evolving. And you can then ask whether there are structural reasons by which you can sort of evade this no-go result and yet get evolution, and that is what I talked about in this talk. And it's essentially this angle of homing down on the choices of what is going to be, you know, this discrete evolution operator or discrete constraint, which that is really where I'm going at. And so I'm not saying that I disagree with what you said. It's just that my angle and my take on things is slightly different. My aims are a little bit different.
Right. So I agree with what you're saying, but I'd just like to probe this a little bit more to understand how things are going to be really different. So, I mean, to some extent, I think in the parameterized theory, there is also, you know, the little x variables which are giving you the notion of time. And implicitly, that is what is also being used in the final result to say that what we are getting is really an evolution. In other words, given a solution to all the constraints, it does represent some evolution. And you're using this embedding value. I mean, you're using the x and t, little x and little t, which are the background structure, to tell you what we mean by time. And I think that that's dissimilar to using deparameterization in terms of something like a scalar field. I'm not tied to scalar field at all. I'll come back to that in a minute. But then the question is the following.
May I interrupt? I sort of like to make a comment. So, the parameterized field theory has a lot of structure in it. There is, of course, a background time, etc. But the intention really is to look at this structure and forget that you have a background time and only look at kind of the structure that of the charge nets and what you can achieve with ultra-local action and through the kernel. And from that point of view, actually what is happening is that you have a certain charge network state, and what you cannot do is really manipulate vertices which are separated through the action of the Hamiltonian constraint. And if you step back, this is really what Lee's objection was, and he wanted to cure it by actually giving you a Hamiltonian constraint, which by hand would take distinct vertices and do something to them. And over here, what I'm trying to say is that it may be possible, and that was the diagram on the last slide, that you can still go exactly as deductively through the theme one logic, get an ultra-local Hamiltonian constraint, but still make choices in such a way that the structure of the Hamiltonian constraint dictates a certain structure of its kernel through which one can see that actually information is being exchanged between vertices which are separated. So I agree that parameterized field theory is this model, and you can either say, well, it worked because we had a background time in it, or you can also say that, well, yes, it did work, you had a background time, but that is really not the crucial aspect of this. What is crucial is the structure of the constraint, which dictates a certain structure of the kernel. And that is my takeaway lesson from here, rather than the fact that, no, everything was only possible because you had this background time. But of course, this is a matter of opinion and where to put more sort of weight and what to do is of course, I mean, this is a subjective thing. So.
No, I'm completely with you. I'm fine with everything you say. I'm just saying that at the end, you get something and you want to call it propagation.
Yes.
If I did not have the little x and little t, I would not know why one is calling it propagation.
Right. And so what I'm trying to say is that, okay, one last try and then we can talk in private. But the last diagram, you know, on the last slide is really my effort to say that you can get vertices to talk to each other. And that is what propagation is about. And that, you know, that was really what I was trying to get at.
Okay. So from this point of view, you would say that something like what Jurek and Christina and other people do is not the kind of propagation you are interested in.
No, I would say that there would be propagation, but it comes due to a structural simplification of the constraint, and it does not really cast light on the various quantization choices which go into part of the constraint. So yes, there is propagation over there. I have no objection to that fact, but propagation would occur presumably for very generic choices of kind of Hamiltonian constraint you use, and
that's exactly
be able to hone in on what it would not be a discriminatory choice. I mean, things would propagate no matter what. So,
So if things that will propagate, how do I say it now? Just one last thing, then I'll stop.
So my accent is more on non-uniqueness and fixing the non-uniqueness, and taking propagation as a criterion. But of course, there may be models and cases in which the constraint structure is such that it's not a discriminatory tool, and then really I don't have, you know.
Right. So from your perspective, it is true that if I have to scale a field, etc., then there is propagation. But that is not the
yes.
kind of propagation you are interested in, because that could happen even when vertices for any factor ordering, as I said.
Yes.
So that is not the kind of propagation you are interested in. You are interested in some notion of propagation which has some feature, and I'm trying to hone in on that, what that feature is. Qualitatively, you are saying that different vertices talk to each other, and I'm trying to understand what that means without referring to a background embedding variable or a scalar field time or something like that. But okay, we can talk later.
Yeah, so this it gets unfortunately into the realm of a little bit of intuitive arguments. And I mean, those are already talked about in Lee's paper, but yes, we can certainly talk about it in more detail later.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, let's thank Madhavan again.